from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Rochester when a college kid playing classical music went to see a jazz band. The band had come in from New York City, and that college kid, Tony Levin, noticed that the bass player in the band was playing a Fender Precision. He'd never seen a bass like that, and after the show, he was, well, feeling good enough to approach the bass player and ask, "Where can I get one of those things?" You know what he was told? Don't get a new one, get a used one. That came with an address in New York City. Tony went there, and without even trying the bass out, he bought it for about $180 and launched a Hall of Fame career. Well, on Sunday night, the Rochester Music Hall of Fame will welcome the 2018 inductees, including Tony Levin. He's going to join Steve Gadd, John Beck, the Campbell Brothers, and Ferdinand J. Smith. And this hour, we've got a chance to sit down with some legends from the world of music, talk about their career, their work, and really anything else they want to talk about. We've got a lot to discuss, and it is great to have Tony Levin in the studio with us. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and I got to ask you, once we get going here, about that bass that you bought.
I was very impressed. That story, frankly, I had forgotten it, but the
it's true, though, isn't it?
Internet, it was true, including the $180. Excellent.
We love to surprise our guests with backstories.
I was surprised. And I liked it that they called it a used one. There was no such expression as a vintage instrument. And in those days, by the way, a new Fender bass was $220, so it was a cheaper version. Things have changed a lot since then.
Yes, indeed. Tony Levin is here. Steve Gadd is back. Well, depending on if you're a percussionist, you might pronounce it Gadd. He pronounces it Gadd. Steve is a drummer of choice for Paul Simon, James Taylor, Eric Clapton, and more. It's great to have you back here. Thank you.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And congratulations to everyone on their inductions, including John Beck, who's been riding Steve's coattails shamelessly for many years. John is a professor emeritus at the Eastman School of Music. I'm mostly kidding about that, John. I think it might be the other way around. He might be riding
your... Well, no, not necessarily. I think you got it right.
Congratulations to you on your induction as well, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Tracy Croft is vice president-elect of the Rochester Music Hall of Fame, and great to have you as well, Tracy. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so there are a number, I think, of great stories and music to discuss, and we have legends here. And what I want to do is sort of get past the more newsy stuff, which is, first of all, Tracy, tell us what's coming up on Sunday night. Let's go do that first.
So 7 o'clock at the Eastman Theater. There may be a handful of tickets left. This is going to be a sold-out show. We're very excited to have these luminaries here, including the Campbell Brothers. And Ferdinand J. Smith rounds out this year's class Above the Grass.
Well, and let me get out of the way a question that sort of popped up on social media after the list of inductees was announced, because I think probably post-October 2017, post-Harvey Weinstein and the Me Too movement, there's a lot more emphasis on gender equity, and a lot of people were pointing to the numbers, and they pointed to a total of 48 inductees to the Rochester Music Hall of Fame now. Five are women. This year's class, 5 people, 0 women. Last year, 6, 0 women. 2016, 6, with 1 woman. That was Wendy O. Williams. 2015, 5, 0 women. 2014, 5 and 1. 2013, 8 and 0. And so a total of 48 and 5. Is that a fair question? Are those? Do you understand why some people were poking at that a little bit? And does that bother you? Is it fair?
Of course I understand that. And I will answer this way. I'm proud to be a founding board member of the Rochester Music Hall of Fame. And when we started in 2009, there were 2 women on that board. Now there's 6. 2 more are coming on board. And 3 of us are going to be in the executive committee. So we're evolving. I'm asked why more women aren't inducted. And we have a 55-page document that has names of musicians worthy of induction. We have a criteria, and there's a selection committee. At the top of the list is Renee Fleming, of course. You all have to understand that we have to work around these performers' schedules. And we got really lucky this year to have Steve and Tony be available. We haven't been quite as lucky yet with Renee, but we know she's going to be there in the next few years. I have to tell you that somebody gathered a little-known fact for me, and I'm going to refer to my notes here. There's a Rochester Business Hall of Fame. And in the last 17 years, they've inducted 163 people, and only 5 were women, which is 4%. In our previous 6 years, we've inducted 38 people, 5 of whom were women, 13%. Same city, same time period, past and present. You know, you're looking at across the board in arts, business, there just weren't as many women as there are men. There just aren't. And that's changing. But even this morning, I was talking to a radio personality who said when he looks at his record collection, for every 10 records by men, he's got one by a woman.
We're going to get him some Ricky Lee Jones.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an awesome idea.
All right. Well, I appreciate you at least addressing that. And in the future years, you think we're going to see more women?
Absolutely. I know it. I know it as we move forward. We make a concerted effort every year. We try to get people here. We try to have a diverse show of genres, you know, and so that makes a difference as well. I'm looking at the young and up and coming women in the Rochester area. Certainly in the next decade, two decades, we're going to have a lot more women up there.
Well, let's talk to some of the people who are being inducted this year. And I know Trace is excited about that. It's going to be a big show on Sunday. And by the way, how long is the performance on Sunday? These things are epic. These are like the most produced things that Rochester does all year. It's amazing.
It is quite an endeavor. Last year, we came in under 3 hours, I think, kind of a miracle. I'm not sure about this year, but I have to tell you, if anybody complains about the length, the quality of the music that they're going to be hearing is going to be...
Thing. That's the thing. If Gad and Levin and everybody else, if they just wanted to, like, go, you're just going to let them go.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got to understand. 7 p.m. Sunday night at the Kodak Hall at Eastman Theater. Tickets priced online anywhere from $25 to $70.
Well, there's only the 25s left.
Okay.
And what a bargain. Are you kidding me?
Only the $25 level left. On sale at the Eastman Theater box office, online, or you can call. And by the way, information online at rochestermusic.org.
And at rochestermusic.org, if you are a community member and you think we might have missed somebody you think should be nominated, there's a place for you to do that. Man or woman, whoever, nominate them, please.
All right, so there you go. There's some of the backdrop of what we're talking about. And Tony Levin, let's go back to those days, which might have been right around the time that you met Steve Gadd. Is that right?
I met him when I came to school at Eastman, 64, 65, 66, around that time.
Okay, and when you were playing, what, a stand-up bass back in that day?
Yeah, I called it a bass. We can call it an acoustic bass. And I was an orchestral player, frankly, when I came in. And I did play in the Rochester Phil, and that was my ambition. And Steve, among other things, introduced me to playing jazz and got me thinking about jazz. After a year or maybe two playing jazz on the upright, I decided it would be nice to have an electric and actually hear myself in some of these bands we play in.
And when you say precision...
And that's worked out really well for me, let me mention.
Oh, I would think so, yeah.
I still play electric quite a bit.
Precision bass, when you use that term, for those who are not in the field, what does that mean?
That's a model of Fender bass. You could call it a Fender bass. Fender makes a jazz and a precision. And I think the reason I first said that story, which was quite a while ago, that you found... was I found it interesting that he didn't even just say get a Fender. He said, told me the very specific bass to get, and I found it fascinating that I went to New York, and right in on the wall he told me to look at in the store he told me to go to, there was exactly that bass, and I played only that bass for many years.
And you didn't even try it out. You pick it up, $180, walk out and said, all right.
I tried it.
Oh, okay. And what do you think about that moment, seeing him play that? Why did it change something in your brain? Because you're playing, again, we would call it a stand-up bass now, but you were enjoying classical music. You're an excellent performer. Why did that shift for you there?
Good question. I can't remember all the details, but the fact is it sounded good. He was a very good bass player. Andy Muzon is his name, playing with Jackie and Roy, by the way, in a Rochester club. And he sounded really great. And we're really all inspired and moved forward by the other players we hear. It could be players on our same instrument or a different instrument, but we're musicians are great listeners. We listen to the whole band that we're playing with and the whole band that we're out to hear. I hear a guy sounding really good on an electric bass that I never heard of or saw before, and I was young then too, and I was curious, hey, maybe I can sound good on that instrument.
And maybe somebody's going to see you playing a Chapman stick.
And the Chapman stick is couple steps beyond. It has 12 strings.
This is what I want to ask Tony, this question, because yours is 12 strings, right?
Correct.
They can be 10?
You're correct.
Okay.
Boy, you're smart about these things.
No, I'm really not. I mean, I can find you on YouTube. That's all I'm saying.
Well, that's smart.
But if somebody sees a Chapman stick and they don't know what it is, what do they usually think it is?
That's a good question. I haven't asked them.
Like a dobro or something?
It could be, yeah. It's called the stick because it looks like a plank of wood. Or you could say that it's a guitar with a very wide fingerboard without the body. You hook it into your belt is how you play it. What's interesting to me is not that stuff about it. That is interesting stuff, but when I first heard about it, I heard that it was an instrument you play by hammer-on or touching the frets. In other words, you don't pluck it with one finger and pick the note with the other finger. Of the other hand, you can play a note with each finger. And I thought, well, that's going to be an interesting way to get a different sound on the bass, especially in the progressive rock situation that I'm in, where a subtly different, the right sound that's different is really a useful tool to me. So that's why I got the Chapman stick quite a while ago, and it's turned out to be very handy for me in that sense.
Have we heard the Chapman stick in popular music without realizing it?
Probably not.
Will we in the future?
Let me think. I'm doing a quick review. King Crimson, the band I play in a lot, all King Crimson fans have heard it for sure on a piece called Elephant Talk that starts with a stick. And I did play it a little bit with Pink Floyd on a record I did with them, but I don't think people hear it. I think really the public is not going to know that it's not a bass if it's me playing it, because I'm a bass player and I'm playing a bass part. Other people play guitar on it.
Yeah, that's the remarkable thing about the Chapman stick, is that it has a really real versatility of sound,
sure,
to it,
yeah,
which I would think has a high bar for learning it. Much more difficult, I would think, to learn.
A bit steep. You know, a bit steep curve. Easy for me because, again, I'm a bass player, and I just took it on the road with Peter Gabriel when I got it and only played the simplest pieces, the very low notes. So it was, I didn't actually tackle the top part for years after I got the stick.
Well, I mentioned Tony Levin, Steve Gadd. They have been involved with some of the biggest names in music. Tony Levin just mentioned Peter Gabriel. I mean, we got one track. We should have an arsenal of tracks. We got Sledgehammer. But, I mean, there's so much that we can do. That we should have here because your career. But when you are looking back at your career, are you the type of musician who thinks, you know, I don't have a favorite album, a favorite piece of work, a favorite, you know, sort of live show, that everything is so different and you like the diversity of performance? Or do you think, yes, for me, this is the best we ever did?
That's a good question, and you were right on with that first part. I actually don't even think back. You know when I think back about what I've done? When I'm doing an interview, which is that. And I remember doing other interviews and thinking back. That's the only time I think back. But on the other hand, the other thing you said, all the shows are very special, all the shows are special and great and very worthwhile, but some of them are extra special. And like, you know, if you're in the audience, sometimes you see a show and you think, this is my eighth favorite concert of all time. Well, it's the same for those of us in the band. We're aware that something magical is happening in this show.
Are you aware when you're cutting a track, whether it's like this one or otherwise, that there's something special there too?
Not really. No. We're all working to make that track as good as it can be. Frankly, I've really made a lot of records in my career. Some of them never came out. I don't know what's going to happen as soon as I walk out of the studio. Even I could be replaced. There could be another bass player on it. Or in the case of Sledgehammer, this part that I quietly played sort of in the background as one of the players, later they decided to mix it really loud and feature it. And when I heard it, I was like, oh, wow, they featured me on this. That was nice.
Pulled it to the front. Let's listen for a second. Do you hear a song like this on the radio when you're driving and you think, hey, that's me? I mean, does that make you think of, maybe even more so than an interview, does that take you back?
A little bit. Frankly, when I'm driving, usually I'm doing homework. I have a CD in there of tracks that I need to learn for what I'm... I like listening to the radio. I don't get to do it much.
Well, let me ask all of the musicians who are with us, and we're talking about the Rochester Music Hall of Fame. The annual induction ceremony is Sunday night at the Kodak Hall at Eastman Theater. And let me ask all of them, and I'll start with you, Tony, and we'll go around the table here. Before the hour began, Tony was joking. He said, I hear you know a little bit about wine. I said, a little about wine and nothing about music, so this is going to be fascinating. But I do recall a conversation with a winemaker who was talking to a group about red wine and oak, and he said, think of a great drummer. He said, most of the time, great percussionists are not dominating the music. They are giving backbone, structure. There are times where they have a more prominent part, but rarely do you want them to be at the center all the time. And that's what I want the oak in red wine to be. So that's how he chose to describe it, which I don't know if John and Steve are going to agree with that, but that was a winemaker's perspective on how he hears drumming and how he wants oak in red wine to be. And I wonder if he would have said the same thing about a bass line.
At one time in my life, I would have said that's exactly right about bass players and about drummers. But then I heard other bass players do what I would have said is the wrong thing and play too much, but do it so, some of them did it so musically and so well. Jaco Pastorius is a great example, that I had to make an exception in my mind and realize, well, not everyone has those rules, and there are boundaries there that can be broken by some people who are such good musicians that they create a new paradigm for the way you can play the instrument, whether it's drums or bass. So though I would have completely agreed at one time, I don't think that way anymore.
But that's different than the sort of the entry-level bass player who thinks, well, I'm going to tear stuff up right now.
Oh, yeah. I'm not talking about that. Overplaying is overplaying. That remains the same.
Okay. But once you understand all the tools, then maybe there are openings, but you've got to be good.
I'm not the teacher. I'm not the one who understands the rules. I think John Beck would know.
You're the
about
guy
that,
who like makes the rules, man.
No, I don't overplay myself, but I appreciate when it works musically, and I'm always being surprised by other musicians, by musicians I didn't know, bass players and drummers who do great stuff that I would have never thought of.
John Beck, how do you feel about the role of percussion in popular music? And again, this is such a bad question because, I mean, it's so, every song is so different and has its own needs. But generally speaking, when you think about the winemaker comparing it that way, saying that, you know, you want the backbone, but you rarely want to dominate. I wonder if you teach that way and then how you feel about that.
Well, it's interesting, Evan, because I am an amateur winemaker, and I've okay. I have been involved this for maybe 25, 30 years. And I was thinking about what you were saying, you two and Tony, and just talking. And I think a winemaker uses their tongue as the tasting instrument to decide if the wine is good. A drummer uses their ears and the feel to see if the music is going to be the right thing. So what one uses, the other doesn't, but we each use something that helps us decide within ourselves that this is what is going to make this piece work. Now, I came from a classical background. There was Beethoven, Brahms, Tchaikovsky, etc. And until I came to school in 1951, I didn't know about these guys. All I knew about was the drum set and Dixieland and that sort of music, the swing era, because that was my era. But when I got here and realized that Brahms, Beethoven, etc., produced the same thing. When I'm playing and when I played timpani in a symphony orchestra and I'm playing a Beethoven symphony, I get to the end of the Ninth Symphony, I can't improvise. But if I'm playing drum set in a big band, when I get to the end of the chart, I can kind of insert a little bit of excitement in there. However, after thinking about this for many years and trying it, I found I could do the same thing in Beethoven, but I had to be subtle, and it had to be through dynamics. It was not that I was changing anything and adding anything, but through my way of handling the dynamics for the end or close to the end, I could create the same kind of excitement. So I equate drum set playing, timpani playing, and cymbal playing in the same genre. Differently, we use it differently, but it does help create excitement in the music. And that's what percussion, if you go way back to the Janissary music, back to the Ottoman Empire, and what they did, making noise to scare the enemy, Beethoven and Mozart picked up as viable sounds that they used in Beethoven Ninth, that the Ode to Joy has cymbals, bass, drum, and triangle. It was never done before, but that came from the Ottoman Empire. But it was subtle, and each composer sort of jumped on that, and it kept building and building until now you get into what I heard last night. I heard the Planets with the Rochester Philharmonic, and I heard a couple other things, all very contemporary, very modern, not like Beethoven. But each one puts something in, subtle, just like the wine guy, just like that man or woman making wine. They use their tongue to help them decide what's going to work.
So I want to go back in time and hang out with you guys when John's teaching and just absorb it. What was that like, Steve?
It was fantastic.
Get on that mic for me. John,
we were talking earlier. He's been my teacher since I was 14.
and helped me through a lot of, I mean, he guided me musically, encouraged me musically, helped me with problems personally that I may have been going through. You know, helped me get into college, helped me get into the Army, encouraged me to do a concerto program. He just made me do things, got me to do things that I would have never done before, never thought I could do.
And do you want to tackle the question that they've been kind of kicking around of do you view percussion in any sort of a context of its place in a song? Is it contextual? Is it you know, sort of song to song, record by record, artist by artist, or do you have a larger vision for what it should be?
No, I think it's song to song, mm-hmm. artist by artist to artist. I mean, rules are made to be broken. You know, I mean, there is no. It's up to the individual how they hear the thing and what they want to inject into the music.
Where our guests are some legends of music, Steve Gadd, John Beck, Tony Levin, and Tracy Croft is here from the Rochester Music Hall of Fame. Their performance is Sunday night at the Kodak Hall at Eastman Theater, and we're told that there are 150 tickets left. So that's the latest update I just got, Tracy. So almost gone.
Almost gone.
And they will be gone by Sunday, you expect.
I wonder if they'll be gone by the end of the day today.
Maybe by the end of this hour.
Could be.
It's the power of connections, listenership.
Absolutely.
What are you most excited about for Sunday?
It's just going to be, I have never had this many butterflies in my stomach over one of these shows. I think everything is going to be fantastic. All these performances are going to be fantastic. You know, one of my favorite things is bringing on the kids for the Lowry Award. And I'll tell you what, the two who were chosen this year are just going to knock the socks off of everyone. And, you know, this is the future. This is the Rochester Music Hall of Fame future.
I'm looking at your list of performances. Tony and Steve are going to perform together on Sunday night, right?
Yes, with some friends of ours, some great musicians who have come up from New York for the show.
Okay. How many tunes are you doing?
Probably three or four. When we rehearse, we'll see how long they're going to take and then decide, you know, then.
We have this image in our minds, I mean, like the lay public who just appreciates your brilliance without understanding it, that you guys can get together after maybe not seeing each other for a long time and go, yeah, like, what do you want to do? Maybe we'll kick it around for half an hour before the show, we'll be good to go. Is that roughly true now?
I think it is for some players and for some bands, and others it's not. We will have tomorrow to rehearse.
We'd need more than a half hour, but we've played a lot with these guys over the years, so I think as soon as we start to play a lot of it, you know, we'll come back.
Are set lists democratic?
Depends on the band and on the guys. This one was arrived at pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, in my band, I do the set list, but...
Well, it's got your name on it.
Right,
I would hope that you've got some,
right.
some sway.
But I mean, in this band, we all sort of, I talked to Mike Maneri and Warren, and we went over some songs, and Tony was on the road, but we came up with an idea and asked Tony about it, and that's how we agreed on what we were going to play.
And I want to ask Tony and Steve about the interplay of bass and drums. I've heard Tony mention that in the studio, the bass very possibly could lose to the drums every time if you're not careful. So versatility is good in instrumentation in terms of what you're playing. We've had some emails from listeners who they all want advice from you guys. You know, they want their kids to be the next Tony and the next Steve and the next John. And we'll get to that in a second. But I want to think about studio musicians and the interplay and how closely you work together. How closely you work with a percussionist as a bass player, Tony?
We call them drummers. That's the first thing. No, because there's a percussionist sometimes in the room. But if you're a bass player in the studio, you have your own little, what we call your mix in your headphones. You can be sure you got the drums up really loud, louder than anything, maybe equal with yourself or maybe even louder than yourself. Why? Because you want to lock in with the whole drum kit, especially the bass drum. Doesn't mean you need to play every note with the bass drum. And lock in doesn't mean you need to be exactly in sync the way a machine would. But you want to be inspired by that groove. You want to, as a bass player, let me tell you, you want to hope it's a really good drummer. And this is not fun if it's not a good drummer. But if it's a good drummer, you just want to be inside that. And still, of course, you need the other instruments to hear the chords and things like that. And so it is a marriage. Bass players and drummers are together. And it comes about even more on the road when you're living the life of being inside those grooves for each piece.
Steve, what's your perspective on interplay of bass and drums, especially in the studio?
Well, in the studio, I like to hear the bass louder than myself. So and if we're playing with a click, I like to hear the click louder. I like to hear what I'm playing with louder than myself. And then I pick and choose other elements that, in the track that are important for what I'm trying to do in terms of laying a groove down. And it's all about getting, like the right headphone balance, get what you need in the phone and get the levels right so I'm not hearing myself louder than everybody else.
Forgive my ignorance on this. How much recording have you guys done together? Actual studio recording?
A good deal. But I don't know how many albums.
Okay, but quite a lot, yeah.
More albums than we remember.
What is the difference, Tony, between working with Steve in the studio versus live?
Oh, that's a good question. In the studio, there's a lot more control. You have that headphone mix I talked about, so you're really living in the perfect world. Live, oh boy, that's what I'll go through Sunday night. All kinds of other things enter into it: the sound of the hall, the other instruments, maybe. In a not perfect world, and it is a not perfect world, maybe I'm not actually standing right next to Steve. Maybe there's someone between us, or maybe some piece of equipment or a curtain that absorbs the sound. And also the volume level, particularly with Steve, he plays with a lot of a big range of volume. So I want to hear him when he's really soft, but I don't want to blow my head off from the monitors when it's really loud, which can happen in a matter of seconds. Mm. So that's frankly a big issue for me. In what we call sound check and setting up the show. So really different live and in the studio.
And you guys hate talking about yourselves, so let me do this. What makes Steve Gadd the best in terms of drums?
Wow. I'm going to say it's not a story, but I've played with Steve a lot, but I've watched him play a lot. Typically, I'll be in Japan on a tour, have a night off, and look around at what's around, and typically Steve will be there with Eric Clapton or some jazz band at the Blue Note, and I'll go see him. And one time, it really struck me, after all the years of playing I've done with Steve, one time I was in a Japanese audience watching an Eric Clapton show, and Steve was and is, anyone who's seen him will agree with this, he's so much as at one with what he's doing when he plays the drums, that fact, even though it's separate than its music, that fact alone draws everyone's attention to him. So I looked around me to see if everyone else was watching Steve in this Eric Clapton piece, and everybody in the whole theater was. And it's not something he's trying to do. He's not putting on a show. He is playing great, but it's not actually that. It's he is at one with his instrument and with his craft, and something inside us all is turned on and fascinated by that.
I think there's something really... fascinating is a great word for that, because I go back to the idea of someone who is an overplayer of any instrument, mm-hmm. the idea of sort of trying to get the audience's attention. And as you say, Steve's not trying to get the audience's attention.
Absolutely.
He's living within the music, but the audience almost can't help it, that they are absorbed by it.
Yes, that's real a fascinating thing about Steve's playing. And I could go on into how he plays the drums and how well he does that, which is also there, the musical aspect. But he's an extraordinary person.
All right, Steve, same question about...
His creativity, his love for new things. We used to ride into New York together to do dates. And, he'd be practicing harmonica, and he'd be able to play it great. his musicianship is inspiring to me. And I love Tony as a person. And everything I love about him as a person comes through in his playing. I don't know any other way to say it. So
that's an important thing. I know a lot. I actually have a lot of musicians in my family who've done regional touring, two brothers who quit college to follow music as a dream. It's very difficult to find bands that have stayed together or musicians that have stayed together for decades and not had a falling out. There's this sordid history in the music industry. So it's just really actually quite beautiful for me to hear you say that, you know, you love him as a person. You may love him as a bass player, but that's inspiring. That's awesome to hear. I'm way late for our only break. I want to talk to John Beck, who's also going to be, you'll be playing quite a lot on Sunday night too, aren't you?
I will be playing.
A solo? Percussion ensemble?
Yes, I'm going to play a timpani solo, actually, that I wrote for Steve when he did his senior recital at Eastman in 1968.
That's awesome.
It's called Sonata for Timpani. I'm playing the second movement, and then I'm playing the second piece is called Mani Volanti, which in Italian means flying hands. It's for three conga drums, bongos, djembe, dumbek, bass drum, and cymbals. So it's kind of a world tune. It covers the whole world. And the last thing I'm going to play is we're going to go back and sit in with the Primetime Funk Band, and I'm going to play Sing, Sing, Sing. But can I go back for just a moment?
Get a little closer to your microphone. Go ahead, John.
I wanted to be a drum set player until I came to Eastman School of Music. And that's when Beethoven and Brahms and those guys got into my blood. And then I realized that what they offered is the same thing that Duke Ellington offered and maybe Count Basie and the other bands, and I could get into this. But there was a bass player in town that I used to work with, and you guys will know him, Barney Mallon. And when I played gigs with Barney Mallon, it really was a great feel. I just get a hold of his coattail, and wherever Barney went, I would make sure I would be there with Barney. And that's such a great feeling. I think we call it in the pocket. It's something that could happen in a Brahms symphony. Maybe I'm with the bass section of the symphony and we're playing out in a timpani part, and their part is the same. And when it's in the pocket, it's a thrill. You can feel it within your body. It's something you can't put into words. It's a feel. It's like the wine. It's a taste. And what we do in drums, one thing about Steve, when he plays two notes, bump, bump, you know it's Steve Gadd because it's the way he tunes the drums. We don't have an A440, A442 for drums. We each tune our drums as we hear them, or the engineer hears them, or the engineer makes us hear them. It depends. But Steve's, the way he tunes his drums is his signature. The way I tune the timpani hopefully became my signature. And so we each have our own little signatures that we hang on to that make us, that thrill us when we know it's working. That's what music's all about. It's the thrill of playing music with others for an audience. And when those two are together, there's nothing better in this world. Even the best bottle of wine couldn't do that.
You're hearing John Beck, Professor Emeritus at the Eastman School of Music, Steve Gadd, Tony Levin. I could tell you who they've played with, but the list would be too long. I mean, Peter Gabriel, King Crimson, Paul Simon, James Taylor, Eric Clapton, Steve Gadd. I mean, like, just goes on and on. Just legendary names. And Tracy Croft is here, Vice President-elect of the Rochester Music Hall of Fame. So let's get this only break of the hour and come right back. Harry, we'll take your phone call. Got a question for the guys, and we'll continue the discussion. Sunday night is the ceremony, and we're told there is, well, maybe 150 tickets or so left for the annual induction ceremony for the Rochester Music Hall of Fame. You can jump online, rochestermusic.org. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, a new mentoring program for high school students aims to help young men address recurring issues that impact their lives as they transition into adulthood. Our guests share their experiences as mentors and mentees and what self-empowerment means to them in today's world. Then in our second hour, as we get older, as we face retirement, how do we make sure we are still valued and feeling relevant? An honest discussion. That's Monday. Welcome back to the program. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me do a couple of things here. Harry, I'm going to grab your phone call in a second. I've had a few listeners who are disputing our numbers on the Rochester Women, the Rochester Music Hall of Fame, the number of men and women. The number I gave earlier was 48 total inductees, only 5 women. Some are saying it's more like 38 or 40. I don't think it really is material what the exact number is, but the bottom line is 5 women total. And I'm only bringing it back up, Tracy, because we've had some pushback on the number. What number do you have? Does it matter?
I had 38.
38 and 5.
In the past 6 years.
Okay.
With 5 women.
Okay.
That was what was given to me, and I think that's about right.
But I will just say, I don't really kind of care what the actual number is. It's roughly, you said 13% women.
Correct.
That's the number that matters. And Tracy addressed that earlier. She said, look, in music, as in a lot of industries, it had been male-dominated for a while, that we've seen more equality in terms of performance, in terms of billing, and all kinds of things, and that you suspect over time that there will be more emphasis on women going forward.
Absolutely.
Fair enough to say?
Fair enough.
Okay. So I hope we've addressed that. Thank you. Let me grab Harry's phone call. Colin from Rochester. Go ahead, Harry.
Yeah, Steve and Tony, I used to work with you guys on the other side of the tracks way back in the early days in Pittsburgh. I don't know if you remember me. I served the drinks. But, Tony, you played with John. I was wondering, you got the Reflections. I think you were the last guy to play with him back in the 80s. You have any thoughts on playing with John?
Yeah, well, actually, I'm asked about, you said John Lennon, right? I actually didn't hear the second word.
John Lennon, you took over to Paul McCartney's job.
Yeah, I did the math here, and I figured out. I'm asked about that often. What I did was, very luckily, I was called to be on the Double Fantasy album with John and Yoko, and that was in 1980, I believe, and when he died, later in the mixing of that album, they ended up releasing a second album, Milk and Honey, out of the same sessions. So I was honored and very pleased to play about 2 weeks in sessions in studio with them both. And there would have been more. There would have been a world tour. And of course, we're all very sad that that didn't happen. And then, unfortunately, I don't have a lot more stories. It wasn't like there was time for him to invite me by his apartment at the Dakota or anything like that.
All right, Harry, thanks for the phone call. Anything you want to add there? Oh, boy. Harry might be in trouble based on that. Thanks for the phone call. We're talking about the Rochester Music Hall of Fame. And, you know, Tony and Steve, having done the work they have done on the road for so many years, I want to ask both of you about your performance schedules these days, your work schedules. I think I'm going to make an assumption that may be wrong, but you guys can you know, disabuse me of it if I am wrong. I think it's probably harder for people who have to sing because as we age, I would think that that may be more difficult. I will tell you that I'm a big Michael McDonald fan, and he came as, I think, part of the Jazz Festival a few years ago. Is that right?
Yeah.
That was fun.
That was awesome.
I was down there pretty much in the front row, just totally unafraid of cutting it loose to Michael McDonald, and anybody you want to come at me, come at me. So what I saw at that night, and this is not at all to be pejorative because his performance was great, it's harder to hit, to belt some of the high notes, and he's turned a little from the microphone, but he's still got it. It was just great. But I just made me think, boy, the vocals he has to do as you get older, it's got to be more difficult. Is it different than playing the bass, and do you feel like if you want, you could do this forever?
Well, it's really different. Yeah, your instrument is different, and different singer. Very few singers have the vocal strength to play five shows, six shows a week. You know, Mike McDonald does a fantastic show, and by the way, I'm sure he turns slightly away from the microphone, not because there's any weakness in his voice, but to make that note a little softer. He's just very much into the studio control of his voice. But very few singers can just hold up to the night after night the way we players can. It's not their fault. So Peter Gabriel will, for instance, do two or three shows a week. When I toured with John Anderson in Yes, he did six shows a week. He just had a strong voice in those days. Steve, you've worked with Mike, haven't you?
With Michael McDonald,
yeah.
Yeah, I did an album with him. It's just that vocal. Yeah, they can't do it like we do it night after night. They got to rest their instrument. And
Paul Simon once told me he had to this was a few years ago, but he said when he's on the road now, he needs to sleep a whole lot each night just to have the vocal strength that night.
Needs to sleep a lot. I know the James likes to do sound checks, not only to get the sound right, but to, you know, start warming up the vocal cords. Paul does the same thing. Eric doesn't do sound checks. He just goes out and does it cold, but not, you know, five or six in a row, though. You know what I mean? Vocalists got to, you know, where we can do five in a row as instrumentalists, the vocalist got to take some time.
Yeah, I just have a special appreciation for it. And I'm a big James Taylor fan because I don't think I've ever heard him miss a note live. One of the most pure live singers I've ever seen. Right. It's just outrageous. And I haven't seen that change following his career over the years. But what's the work schedule for you, Stephen? Is this the kind of thing where can you ever see yourself kind of taking a break, walking away at all from the drum kit?
I don't see myself walking away from the drum kit, but you know, I see myself not working as much in the future. You know, spending a little bit more time with my family. Although the next year is pretty busy too. So it's you know, I mean, that's the plan, but. You know, things happen along the way, so we'll see what happens.
I put it a different way. I would say we musicians have brilliantly planned our careers so that retirement isn't an option.
Yeah.
That's pretty brilliant when you think about it. Yeah. That's the way I like to think about it.
We're going to have a conversation on Monday on the program inspired by my father, who was forced into retirement because of the career he was in. He was an attorney, and there was an age of retirement, and he didn't want to retire. And he said, you know, when you wake up and you can't go to work, because, I mean, it's a privileged situation to be sure, but when no one cares if you show up and no one's calling you, it's actually hard. It's hard to feel relevant. And that sparked an idea, and we're having a discussion on Monday about, you know, making sure we still value people who are not as young as they used to be, but valuing contributions, ideas, wisdom. And so you'll hear my dad on Monday, but we're going to have a conversation much more between me and my father. I just was curious because I think Tony and Steve and certainly all the people are going to be on stage on Sunday night. I hope you never stop. And I think that there's something really almost brilliant about having this career where you can keep creating new and contributing in a way and the world is just clamoring for it. And that, why do you laugh at that? It's true, isn't it?
I'm not sure. I haven't noticed that the whole world is clamoring, but you have enough of an audience that you can keep doing it. That's enough.
Yeah, I mean, do you think about that? I mean, is that kind of a privilege to you to say, "Wow, I can do this now, and I can travel. The best musician of the world still want to play with me."
I don't have that thought every day, but I'm very grateful for it. Sure.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. John, go ahead.
Can I just say something about getting old? Because I happen to be the oldest person in this room right now. And what happens to drummers, percussionists, as they get older? Their muscles get a little slower. There's no question about it. You can still think fast, but can your hands go as fast as you're thinking? That is a problem. So I have in the last, all I do now as far as playing is I teach the history of percussion class. That's just talking, sitting around a table like this, and we talk about the history. But I have my own campaign where it's like going to the gym, but it's not a gym I go to. It's a drum pad. This is a little practice pad that we have. And I make sure that my routine is followed each day where I can still keep these things going. The more I relax, the faster I get. Not the louder will I get faster. It's the relaxing. And so that's where I am right now. And it's working. We'll find out if it's working on Sunday. But I think it's working for me. So like golfers, I've often thought about playing percussion and related to, you know, the winemaking or sports and so on. Golfers, your golfers don't hit the ball as far. I don't play as fast anymore. But if I'm playing drum set, because it's primarily improvisation, I adjust my tempos and my what I play to what I know I can do. If I'm playing in a symphony orchestra, which I don't anymore, if Beethoven says it has to go this fast, I got to make sure I can go that fast, but I may not. But I can adjust that if I'm playing drum set. So I've put myself in a nice little position where I can make it look easy, even though it may be difficult inside.
That's smart.
Well, I love it, John. We just heard some of your drum solo right here. That's what we're hearing now. That's you.
Oh, yes, it is.
What are you playing here? What do you recognize that?
That's a timpani solo.
Boy,
or it could be a little bit of an improvisation. I was playing a multiple set there. I'm not quite sure what that was.
But that came from the PR from your guys, from the Music Hall of Fame.
Those are my licks.
Those are your licks.
I understand those
licks
I'm playing, yes.
I love it. I love the fact that John is saying, you know, you can hear a couple of notes and you know it's Steve Gadd on the drums. Tony, you agree with that? You can pick out a Steve Gadd?
Yeah, maybe not every time, but generally,
sure.
Yes.
Yeah, and also, do you feel that way about Tony and bass line, Steve?
I can recognize Tony's playing.
I think what we become good at is for me, for telling the bass player, which bass player it is. And for Steve, I know a lot of drummers who really revere and have studied the history of other drummers and recognize little subtle things that even I don't hear in, you know, Elvin Jones or Philly Joe Jones parts. So yes, a lot of musicians are sort of experts at the history of their own instrument.
I've got a couple questions from the audience. Jack wants to know, could you ask Steve and Tony if they remember Red Creek from the 70s?
Oh, yeah.
Very well. Very, very well. We remember it fondly.
Yeah, great shows we did there.
Tell the audience who don't know Red Creek, like me.
Well, it was a club that had live music. Jeff Springett owned it, and Tony and I played there with Mike Holmes. We had a trio at East. You know, Mike went to Eastman when we were all in school, and we played a lot there. And then when I left Rochester, I'd come back and play there with different bands. You know, with Richard T. and I can't. Oh, well, with Limage.
Limage,
we played there a lot.
The very band we're playing with on Sunday night.
Limage played a lot at Red Creek. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun.
Jack also wants to know, he says he remembers that Tony played the fretless electronic bass. Did he use this instrument due to Jaco Pastorius from Weather Report?
I played fretless. That's an interesting question. I played the fretless bass. I'm not the only one who plays. It's a very common instrument. I played it before I ever heard Jaco, and went. After hearing Jaco more than once, after hearing a bit of it, what he was doing, I found that I didn't want to play the fretless anymore. He just did it so well. He did it the way, musically, I dreamed of doing it. And I knew that for the time being, anyway, I wasn't going to be happy with the way I was playing it. So I just kind of put it aside. Very easy to do, because I can play the fretted bass anytime I want. And about 10 years after that, I picked it up. Actually, I heard another great bassist who did a different kind of approach on fretless bass, Carlos Benavent, a Spanish bass player. Have you played with him, Steve?
Yeah.
Wow. And I thought, well, okay, not that he wasn't better than I could ever be, but I thought, okay, I'm ready to pick it up again. Strange.
Great stories this hour. And John and Henrietta, let's squeeze in a quick phone call. Go ahead, John.
I just wanted to comment, Tony, thanks for all the photos you take, and you've been doing this since, I think, before digital photography, but pre-show stuff, rehearsal stuff, and then stuff in the live audience. I can barely see myself at the Philadelphia Peter Gabriel show about 4 years ago. That was fantastic.
Well, thank you. What he's talking about is what I call my road diary that I keep up on TonyLevin.com. And I tried, recently I added a feature where the pictures I take of the audience at the end of the show, if you click on it, you can blow it up. Maybe you should try that. If you didn't, it sends you to a link to a bigger version of that, very much so that you can get a picture of yourself off the site. I've loved that thing about the web that it enabled, in a way it tore down a wall between a rock band and its audience. It enabled us to share what goes on behind the scenes, or in my case, share the wonderful aspect of how great the audience looks to those of us on stage. It's something you would never think about. And those are my favorite pictures that I take.
That's great stuff. Thank you, John. And before we lose the hour, let me ask Tracy Croft from the Rochester Music Hall of Fame. There's a lot we probably didn't even get to this hour, and a lot you're looking forward to as you induct 5 new members on Sunday night, including John Beck, Steve Gadd, Tony Levin, but also you're inducting Campbell Brothers and Ferdinand J. Smith. So what are we missing that we haven't really talked about?
Ferdinand's got a huge group of people playing with him, including Primetime Funk, our house band, and they've been working diligently to practice a lot of tunes, and it's going to be a great show. And Sing, 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 one of my ultimate favorite songs, and that's John Beck with Primetime. And the Campbell Brothers. The Campbell Brothers are going to have Robert Randolph here. So I think the roof's going to be blown off the house this time.
Sing, Sing, Sing was the song that we used to close. My first job ever was at a place called Moto Photo, back when there was something called film that they made right here in Kodak.
They did.
And yes. I was in Ohio working this job, and the manager who would close with me, who ended up buying the Moto Photo right before digital, I remember, first of all, he demanded, John, that we close to Sing, Sing, Sing because that would get us upbeat to get the store done quickly and happily. And I remember one night, and I said to him, when you own this place, are you going to be doing Sing, Sing, Sing? He said, I'm always going to own this place, and there will always be film. And that was right on the time the Advantix wow. camera came out, and he said, film will never die. He bought the thing, and then I think he probably went out of business. But Sing, 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 Sing remains. So
it's one of those songs that the drummer plays, boom, 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 boom. They know it's Sing, Sing, Sing.
Yes,
it just became, it really became the focal point for drummers of the future. What Krupa did with that thing just set us all and gave us a job. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Steve. Mm-hmm. We got it.
When you're not performing, let's do this real quick here since we've got about 40 seconds left. When you're not going to be performing Sunday night, remind our audience where they're going to find more of your music because you are still very active, Steve. And what are you working on now?
Well, after this, I start James Taylor's tour for the summer. So that'll be the next thing. And then in the fall, I'll be doing some more touring with my own band. It's just trying to put the puzzle together, you know, keep the pieces lined up.
Gotcha. Tony?
I'll tour the rest of this year with King Crimson and with my group Stick Men and with my other group, 11 Brothers. And I hope Peter Gabriel tours in the next couple of years, but there's no plan for one.
Well, thanks for taking the time and indulging our questions. And it's just been so much fun. Tony Levin.
Thank you, Evan.
John Beck, thank you. Great having you. Steve Gadd.
Thank you.
And I know they're excited to be there Sunday night. They'll see you there 7 p.m. Less than 150 tickets remaining, and who knows, might be sold out by now, but rochestermusic.org. Is that right, Tracy?
Yep, or the Eastman Box Office.
Or the Eastman Box Office. Thank you as well. Have fun Sunday night.
We will. Thank
you. Our thanks to the engineer, John Andrus, and producer, Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a lovely weekend. I hope you all thaw out and spring finally gets here, and we'll talk to you Monday on member-supported public radio.